Okay, I'd like to call today's meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Today is January 31st, 2024. It's 1:03 p.m. We are located in the Capitol Room 124. We have a full committee present today. Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, Representative Baker, Representative Rauscher, Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dibert, Representative McCabe, and myself, Chairman Tom McKay. We have a quorum to do business. With us in the audience, we have Commissioner John Boyle. Thank you, Commissioner, for being with us today. And I'd like to thank the staff, Zach, Justin, and Ed King, Committee 8, for helping us run the meeting. Please put your cell phones on silent, and we will begin today. We have two items on our agenda. Both are related to Cook Inlet gas. And the first, the bills are House Bill 276 and House Bill 223. So we will begin with House Bill 276. I will now bring House Bill 276 related to Cook Inlet gas before the House Resources Committee. The Department of Natural Resources will be presenting the bill on behalf of the governor. So our presenters today are Commissioner John Boyle, Deputy Commissioner John Crowther, Director Derek Nottingham, and on the line we have Johnny Mesa. So, gentlemen, please come forward, and if you could state your names and your affiliations, obviously, and begin your presentation.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chairman McKay and honorable members of the committee. This is John Boyle. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. With me, I have Derek Nottingham, my division director for oil and gas, and John Crowther, who's my deputy commissioner, and Johnny Mesa, who's our commercial manager within the Division of Oil and Gas. And my learned colleagues will be carrying most of the technical aspects of the discussion today, but I thought I'd just get kicked off by some high-level remarks on my end as we prepare to delve into this topic of Cook Inlet oil and gas royalties and associated issues. From a DNR standpoint, the challenges that we're facing in the Cook Inlet right now aren't related to the resource. And the reason I say that is because we have ample gas resources available in the Cook Inlet. And that's ample gas resources that are available under either existing platforms or platforms that could be permitted within a relatively short period of time. These gas resources have been well explored, they're relatively well delineated, and we have a high level of confidence in operators' ability to be able to produce from these gas reservoirs. So when we start looking at the challenges that are currently facing Cook Inlet, we're not really talking about resource challenges. We're not really talking about technical or engineering challenges. What we're talking about are commercial challenges that are inhibiting the development of these gas resources. And so HB 276 is one of a suite of tools that we believe will help to address those financial challenges, those commercial challenges for the operator. As we've had conversations with the various operators in the Cook Inlet, one of the things that has been clear is that the economics of Cook Inlet production are challenging. Over the course of its nearly 60-year history, really, it's been the oil element of Cook Inlet production that has driven the economics for the companies that are producing in that area. And as a kind of a consequence or a byproduct, we've received the gas, you know, from those oil exploration prospects. As we move on in time, the oil is becoming more and more difficult to find. And so as developers look to step out and to drill new wells and things of that nature, the fact that the oil may be more challenging to get then plays a role in terms of the economics that then can challenge the production of gas. Because if you don't have a lot of oil, even if you have a lot of gas, you might be able to sell enough to supply the domestic needs of the Alaskan economy, but anything above and beyond that amount, there's not necessarily a ready market for that. And so those are some of the various issues that companies have to look at. But as we've had conversations with our existing producers in the inlet or prospective producers, the one thing that they've all mentioned is that it is difficult for them, or a lot of their development projects are within that margin of either being investable or not. So as they go out and meet with banks, private equity groups, other individuals willing to invest in these projects, the returns that they can offer are right on that line of where investors might say, you know, if we take our money and we invest it in this project over there, we might enjoy the same or a higher rate of return and maybe incur less risk as a result of that activity. So for the department, one of the things that we've looked at is what are one of the levers that we have to reduce that risk? And royalty is one of the things that we've focused on that we feel makes one of the most meaningful contributions to the economics of these projects that we feel can help incentivize and kind of push over the line the internal rates of return that these projects hope to receive and hope to promise investors. And so we've started with that as, I guess, a starting point in terms of changing the economic picture of the Cook Inlet. So maybe just to frame up again of kind of what this bill is and isn't. So some of you may know the Department of Natural Resources offered a lease sale at the end of last year, which included new terms. So instead of actually offering a royalty rate, we offered leases that were based on a net profit share basis, which is roughly akin to what you see in other countries, to where operators are allowed to develop fields, start producing oil, recoup costs, and then they start paying the sovereign a certain amount once they have recouped their costs and have become profitable or cash flow positive. So these net profit share leases are things that we felt might be a good incentive to help companies have more confidence in the economics of going out and bidding for new leases and potentially developing new areas. So we rolled that out because that exists under DNR's current authorities. And as a result, we did see a slight uptick, I would say, in lease interest and activity in Cook Inlet. But these, of course, are prospective projects. These are leases in areas that have maybe never been explored before or where the exploration needs more work to delineate or prove up the resource. So these are sort of highly speculative areas. The legislation that you have before you today deals with leases that already exist, leases that may already be parts of units, and where there is not currently, or where there may be the potential to bring new production online. So this legislation specifically relates to those existing leases where we hope to incentivize new production. This legislation does not deal with existing production, so this does not lower the royalty rate for those producers in the Cook Inlet that are already producing oil. This would just apply to producers in the inlet that have leases that are already established at the 12.5% royalty and that would lower those royalty rates down. So again, we feel that this is a great first step to help provide better economics for our producers. We recognize that if the state doesn't take more proactive steps along this front, that it's likely that we may not see new development take place. And I'll add to a corollary to this. One of the important messages that I think this legislation would send if enacted is that for these companies that are out meeting with banks, meeting with investors, one of the concerns that they've expressed to us is that investors have some uncertainty when it comes to investing in Alaska. They have seen fiscal changes that have impacted things like tax credits were available for Cook Inlet producers. They've seen proposals to change sort of the fiscal take structure in the state. And so I feel that by seeing this legislation move forward and passing the legislature, it will send a signal to investors that, one, the state and you as the policymakers strongly support development within the Cook Inlet, that we all recognize that having a stable homegrown energy supply that is relatively affordable is in the state's interest, and that the state is going to look to enact policies that encourage that kind of production rather than discourage that type of production. So with that, it's kind of long-winded remarks, but hopefully that helps frame up a little bit kind of where things stand, where our perspective is on this. And of course, we'll look forward to having this dialogue with you as we actually move forward into the meat of the presentation. So with that, I'll step back. If there's any specific questions for me, I'll be happy to take that. And if not, then we'll turn things over to my able director here.
Thank you, Commissioner Boyle, for the opening remarks. I would like you to, I think we should emphasize at this point that this is not a tax credit program like we had in the past, where we actually used fungible funds out of the state treasury to help finance oil and gas projects. This actually leverages gas that's still in the ground that may never be produced. And so I would really like to make sure that the public understands that those are two different concepts, and maybe you could say that better than I can, but I think we should emphasize that at the very outset, that this is a different program than what we did in the past. And maybe you could expand on that just a bit before we go to the slides.
Absolutely. And I appreciate those remarks, Chairman McKay, because I believe that is an important concept to get across. What we are talking about here is not the state giving money to producers or subsidizing or anything that was similar to the tax credits that were associated with the Cook Inlet Recovery Act. What we're talking about here is the state being willing to take a smaller share in order to improve the economics for these projects to move forward. So instead of collecting a 12.5% royalty rate, the state would look to collect a 5% royalty rate, because from the state's perspective, we'd rather have 5% of something than 100% of nothing. And I think the risk is, if we don't make these tweaks, then we may get that 100% of nothing. So that's what we're hoping to avoid. And one other point that I'll bring out is, while we're all very focused around gas on this table, since nearly all of us, with a few exceptions, are heavily reliant on Cook Inlet gas for heating our homes and providing power for our homes, Cook Inlet oil is also something that is very important. Cook Inlet oil is what supplies our in-state refineries, which the vast majority of our gasoline and a lot of our aviation fuels are based off of. And so this bill also lowers the royalty rate for oil, of course, that's produced in these leases, which, again, I think we want to continue to see that oil production keep pace so that we're meeting local demand for gasoline and other oil derivative products. So I just want to make sure that we also point out that the oil side of the Cook Inlet is also an important element of the business to keep in mind, and this bill addresses that. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's take time. Let's begin with the slides, please.
For the record, I'm Derek Nottingham, the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and my colleague, Johnny Mesa, the commercial manager, is on the line to answer any questions that you guys have that I may not be able to answer. And so, yeah, we're going to kind of go over, you know, why this is important and some background on the Cook Inlet history and the current situation, what our forecast is, and then we'll get into the bill. So we'll roll through some background slides here and kind of set the stage, and then get into a little bit more of the meat of the bill. Why is Cook Inlet gas important? This slide really indicates that about 70% of the state of Alaska depends on Cook Inlet gas, either for heating their homes or for providing electricity. As you can see, natural gas, NSTAR, Interior Gas Utilities, getting close to 450,000 people that are affected. Electric utilities, Chugach Electric serves 302,000 people. Anchorage, Whittier, Girdwood, and Fairbanks. Matanuska Electric, 180,000 people. Homer Electric, 36,000 people. And to the right, you see the volumes of Cook Inlet gas that are under contract by these entities. NSTAR making up about half of the volume that's under contract, with the other companies, Chugach, a pretty good percentage. Homer and IGU MEA also making up a good chunk of the Cook Inlet gas that is currently under contract. So this slide really gives us a little bit of perspective of what the Cook Inlet Basin is. The map on the right shows the Cook Inlet units. At the very top of right of the map, you can see Fire Island. And then you can just to the west of that, you can see North Cook Inlet. So when you're flying into Anchorage, a lot of times you're approaching, you're flying kind of halfway in between that North Cook Inlet unit and Fire Island, and then making the approach back into the Anchorage airport. So very, very close to home for folks that that live in Anchorage. The units you see there, the ones in yellow, those are state units. You can kind of see the kitchen lights units is the biggest unit in the Cook Inlet. Some historical units that have been there for quite a while, like the Trading Bay unit since the 1960s. The Nanilchik unit down towards the south that you can kind of see is a onshore unit on state land. And then the Swanson River unit, which is in green out to the east there, that was, that's been there since 1958 or 59, producing oil and gas for quite a long time, going on 50 or 60 years. So this basin is a very mature basin in terms of the leases, the units, the fields that have been produced. Some of them are getting on their last legs, the last bits of oil and gas are being produced out of them, and it's getting tougher and tougher to find additional oil and gas within the existing fields. 1.4 billion barrels of oil is quite a substantial amount of oil, and 12 trillion cubic feet of gas produced. Currently 26 fields being produced by 8 different companies and 200 oil and gas leases. Really, the basin's been declining from an oil standpoint and a gas standpoint since 1990-ish. The peak gas production was in 1990 at 850,000 cubic feet per day. That's I'll refer to that as 850 million cubic feet a day. It's just a little bit less than 1 billion cubic feet a day. Current production, so where we are today, is less than a quarter of that. We're down to 200 million cubic feet a day, roughly. And as we mentioned, Cook Inlet provides heat and electricity to 70% of Alaskans. So before we kind of get into a little bit more of the history, just to talk very generally about what a state of Alaska oil and gas lease is. It's a lease of it's a tract of land that's designated for oil and gas exploration. So the Cook Inlet Basin has been designated for oil and gas exploration. Those leases are offered through lease sales or through the Cook Inlet leases are offered through lease sales. Leases can also be offered through exploration license. A primary lease term is generally between 5 and 10 years. The statutory maximum on that is 10 years. And what holds the lease beyond the primary term for an operator is commercial production. So establishing production on that lease is what allows that operator to continue to operate and lease that land. And then what's a unit? So a unit is a combination of leases to combine resources from all parties to ensure that the reservoirs, the subsurface is managed properly, to ensure that surface uses are managed efficiently. And so we typically, and I don't think there are any lease-only production operations in the Cook Inlet. It's only we only have units that produce. So when we talk about managing Cook Inlet production, we're talking about production that's coming from a unit. And that unit is managed through what we call a unit agreement. And that's basically a contract that's developed between the lessees and the state. That unit agreement requires, typically on an annual basis, a development plan or a plan of development. We'll call it a POD. And that requires that the operator provides evidence of activities that they've done in the previous year, plus activities that they're going to do to develop the leases in the next year and years after that. And it requires the operator to act prudently to develop the unit and serve their interest, but also the state's interest. I'm not a geologist. I'm a petroleum engineer. So forgive me if I make a few errors in kind of describing the geology, but I'll just kind of do my best to give you an idea what the Cook Inlet Basin is from a geological standpoint. So on the west side, you can kind of see like the Alaska Range coming down and the volcanoes that kind of make up the western side of the Cook Inlet. And on the east side, the Kenai Peninsula, Chugach Mountains. And in between there, it forms like what I call a really nice fetch basin for these fluvial systems to come in and deposit sand. And on the right, what you can see is the stratigraphic column that's developed over time as these fluvial systems have laid down sand and meandered back and forth. Towards the bottom, you see the deeper sands in the Jurassic and Cretaceous. Those tend to be harder rock. They tend to have oil and are considered actually the source rock for Cook Inlet oil. As you move up in section, the rocks become a little bit more permeable, a little bit more porous. And so through the Chicoloon, West Foreland, and Hemlock formations, that's where quite a bit of the oil productions come from. It's especially in the Hemlock, that's where much of the Cook Inlet oil has come from. And then as you get shallower into the Tyonek, Beluga, and Sterling formations, that's where we have a lot of our gas production. And those that gas is formed from biogenic gas related to coal.
Can we get through the slide, Representative Sadler? And then we'll ask questions at the end of the slide. Is that okay?
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chair McKay, I'm done with the slide.
Oh, you're done. Okay. Well, you did good on the geology there. Okay, I'm sorry, Representative Sadler, your question.
Your minor point, looking at I understand the chronological column, but looks like, is it meters MA? I'm not sure from MA. Is that meters, 5 meters, 24 meters, or is that 500 meters, 200?
I believe that's in millions of years.
That's millions of years.
Gotcha. Okay.
At the bottom, 208 million years.
Good.
Geologic time.
Yep.
Okay, please continue.
So we've talked about how much the Cook Inlet has produced, but the USGS did a survey in 2011 to understand the remaining or the unproduced, undiscovered, technically recoverable oil and gas in the inlet. And they determined that there was 599 million barrels of oil, 13.7 trillion cubic feet, or TCF, of conventional gas, and 5.3 trillion cubic feet of unconventional gas. Unconventional gas meaning in plays like coal bed methane. And then on the OCS, the Outer Continental Shelf, which the arrow is kind of indicating where that is, 1.2 TCF of gas resource in the OCS waters. So the governor's legislation, as the commissioner mentioned, is targeting making the undiscovered and undeveloped gas on state lands more economic to develop. This chart really shows that production history, with oil peaking back in the 1970s and then on decline. the gas peaking in 1990 at 850 million cubic feet and declining from there. You can also see the water production coming in. A lot of that is associated with secondary or enhanced recovery methods, such as water flooding, those water kind of coming through the wells and being produced. This slide shows a little bit more about the makeup of the companies that have produced gas from oil and gas from the Cook Inlet. The slide on the chart on the left is gas production on state lands only, but in the companies that made up that production over time, starting in the year 2000. So as you can see, back in the early 2000s through about 2010-ish, a lot of the companies that were producing from state lands were the bigger companies, ConocoPhillips, Marathon, Chevron, made up, you know, some pretty big names with pretty big capability. As you move, you know, in the last 15 years or so, Hillcorp is the predominant producer along with some other smaller producers. So the landscape, it has definitely shifted in terms of the companies that produce there and their capabilities. On the right, you can kind of see the makeup of the fields that have been producing since the 2000s or since even before that. Just each individual field, as you notice, the big ones have been declining over that time. And I guess the other piece of that is there's not really been a major new field that has come online in that time. And this slide gives you a bit of background on the makeup of production from the last year in terms of which fields the production is coming from, and also the companies that are operating those leases in those fields. And by and large, Hillcorp is, as we've mentioned, the dominant producer in the inlet with over 80% of the production. The bigger fields, and you're probably fairly familiar with these names, the Beluga River Field, the Nilchik, North Cook Inlet, those are the big gas producers. Off to the right, you'll also see that the oil production, and oil production is important, as the commissioner mentioned. Oil production today is around 9,000 barrels a day, so and on decline. So it is something that we do want to keep our eye on. A little bit about gas storage on this slide. So what is gas storage? So gas storage is basically, a gas storage reservoir is basically a depleted gas reservoir. So it's been produced, it's down at a low pressure, and now we can kind of turn things around and inject gas into it. And why is that beneficial? Because the wells that produce gas in the Cook Inlet, they like to continually produce, even in the summer months when the need for gas isn't quite as high. But keeping those wells online, keeping them going is important just for the proper operation and simplicity of operation. So gas storage is important so that we can, in the summer months, basically produce those wells into those storage reservoirs, pressure up the storage reservoir, and as winter comes along, we have gas available to meet the peak demand. There are four current active gas storage pools in the Cook Inlet right now. Tsingshan is one of them. It's the only one that's an RCA-regulated utility. It has a storage capacity, so how much of that pore space in terms of gas can it take? It's about 18 BCF, so it has an 18 BCF operating capacity. Kenai Gas Pool 6, that's operated by Hillcorp, 50 BCF. Pretty Creek, towards the north, a little bit smaller, or actually a lot smaller, but gas storage capacity of about 3 BCF. and Swanson River, 3.4 BCF. So SINGSA operates one of the gas storage facilities. The other three are operated by Hillsborough.
Okay, Representative Mears has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Are there other potential opportunities for storage that are being explored or potential anytime soon?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Mears, yeah, I do believe that other opportunities are being explored by various producers, operators in the Cook Inlet, and as well as potentially the utilities are looking at it.
Okay, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Director Nunningham. Just look at the slide here. So SINGSA is RCA regulated, but the others are not. Those are privately owned and not regulated. Is that federal? I was curious why SINGSA would be and Kenai Gas Pool and Pretty Creek are not.
Representative Sadler, through the chair. This is Deputy Commissioner John Crowther for the record. Are existing oil and gas leases grant operators the right to store their own production on their own leases? And so those operated by Hillcorp have the right to store Hillcorp production so that it can be used to meet those deliverability demands. Now, we have authorized third-party storage from a lessor perspective in the Kenai Pool 6, but were that storage to move forward and be brought onto the market, depending on how the RCA exercises its authorities, it might require regulation if third parties access it.
Okay, please continue.
This slide really indicates the Cook Inlet gas demand over time. So back in the early 2000s, not only were there the electricity and heating needs of the Anchorage and rail belt areas, but also the fertilizer plant, the nutrient fertilizer plant was online. The Kenai LNG exports were going. Those two industries have since shut down operations. The fertilizer plant going offline in 2007. The LNG exports last export was in 2015. So the demand for Cook Inlet gas has basically shrunk to basically the current utility needs plus some industrial needs, such as the Marathon refinery and also some general oil and gas field operations such as injection and fuel gas. So that's where we get to the roughly 70 BCF per year of gas demand that's required from the Cook Inlet. Last year, in response to Hillcorp coming out and saying that and telling utilities that they were basically just going to be able to meet their existing contracts and not committing to further anything further than that, but we put together a forecast to understand the gas supply and the resource availability in the Cook Inlet. So this was an independent analysis to provide information on the gas supply issue in the Cook Inlet. It's something that we have the capability in-house to do. We have reservoir engineers, geologists that can help us put this information together. Utilized public data from the Cook Inlet units. It basically using accepted petroleum engineering practice such as the Klein curves, and a standardized set of economic limits were used for each unit to understand the economic viability and when and if there would be fields that would be shutting in the future during this forecast. The key assumptions in this forecast were that 15 development wells would be drilled per year until 2030, and no new wells beyond that. Recognizing that 15 wells per year was based on the inventory of what the Cook Inlet operators knew they had available to drill on their leases, on their units, and doesn't necessarily mean that no new wells will be drilled beyond that, but these were the assumptions that we knew at the time, that the operators knew at the time. It also assumes that prices are flat, gas price is flat, and demand is flat at 70 BCF. And it doesn't include contribution from non-producing known prospects. We're not forecasting any future developments that haven't been sanctioned at this point in this forecast. And this doesn't include gas produced from storage either. This is just strictly a supply-based forecast. I believe you probably are familiar with this particular slide or something very similar to it. The blue line on the top represents the yearly Cook Inlet gas demand that we're estimating, around 70 BCF per year. That could fluctuate to some degree, but 70 BCF is around where it averages. The bar charts show what we call proved developed gas in the blue, and then the incremental proved undevelopment, or simply put, that's the drilling wedge from those 15 development wells that we assume are being drilled every year. And so you can see for the first 4 years of this forecast, the supply is roughly meeting the demand. And then after 2026, in the 2027, 2028 timeframe, the supply is falling off demand, even with continued drilling. And the other piece to that to note is that continued drilling is a large chunk of the future supply from the Cook Inlet. So it is an important piece that needs to continue in order for the area to continue to meet the demand.
Okay, yeah. Oh, I'm very sorry, Representative Mears.
That's quite all right. Thank you. Through the chair, this might be a larger question that we want to take on as a committee, and we might need to involve other departments, but we're talking about market development here and investor certainty, and we've got a flat line here on demand. Is there space, either with what work DNR is doing or perhaps DCCED, on what other potential energy demands there would be? Because if we're signaling that we're a good place to invest, is that another route for proving that we've got a larger demand potential?
Yeah. Representative Mears through the chair, Commissioner Boyle for the record. I think there's certainly an opportunity to market more, see a demand increase. We, as Director Nottingham mentioned, both the refineries, industrial users continue to need natural gas. We also know that, for instance, certain mining prospects, Donlin Gold is the first one that comes to mind, was exploring the viability of building a pipeline that extended from the Cook Inlet out to their mine site. That would be a significant industrial user of gas. There's a number of other mineral and mining prospects around the Susitna Valley that may be interested in consuming Cook Inlet gas. We continue to have the Nutrien plant that is down in Nikiski as well, that in theory, if enough gas were discovered and produced and made available, may have an opportunity to resume operation for some production. So certainly I think there are opportunities there to look at growing demand, assuming we can get the economics right to see some of these new developments take shape and move forward.
Okay, so I'd like to focus on this slide a little bit, Derek and John. This slide is really important because what I think it says to us, this is with one jackup rig in the inlet currently, operating with a full schedule, from what I understand. And this graph projects what would happen if, basically, if we make no changes. This would be the future as best we could predict it. So as everybody knows, 2027 to 2028, you start falling short. So I think the point I would like to make is time is of the essence. The time is now. I think this decision or action or, you know, discussion is maybe we're a little late. So I want to think we really need to consider this real seriously. The 15 wells per year is vitally important. If you don't get the 15 wells per year, give or take, you fall below the line. As you've shown in previous slides, there is gas in the inlet. There could be a lot of gas in the inlet based on what the geologists tell us. There is also gas out there that's not developed yet, and we know where it is. And if I say anything wrong, please correct me. But we know there's gas at Cosmopolitan. We know there's gas at Kitchen Lights. So my thinking is, when I look at this, it's almost essential that we start figuring out how to add a second jackup. I don't see any other way to make it happen without a second jackup to give us more than 15 wells per year. You could say that you need 30 wells per year to fill that gap with just gas from Cook Inlet. I'm trying not to complicate the discussion by talking about renewables, talking about coal, talking about all these other things. I think just for our simplicity of discussion, we'll just keep it simple and just focus on, you know, what we know and on this slide. And so those are, you mentioned the Donlin Gold Mine. They would like to have gas from Cook Inlet. But when you look at this, it's like, oh, sorry. So there's a project that could employ, you know, hundreds of people, provide revenue to the state. And unfortunately, because of our situation here, we're not able to advance that project forward. So it's very important slide. So did I say anything wrong?
Through the chair, I would be... I would not say that you said anything wrong, and even if you did, I don't know that I would stick my neck out and say so. But no, I think you framed up the argument well, which is under sort of status quo assumptions, we do see the shortfall. But as you rightfully point out, we know where the gas is currently, and we know where the opportunities are to spur that gas into production. And as you rightfully point out, without us veering maybe too far afield and getting too complex, there are a suite of other issues as well that we have to keep our eyes on. You mentioned the jackup rig. That is an important issue. The strength of the service sector in the Cook Inlet is another issue. As the Cook Inlet industry has sort of gone into decline, we've seen an erosion of the ability of contractors and suppliers in the Cook Inlet being able to provide the same level of service and support that they have historically. I mean, some of that is also a result of the fact that we see so much investment now flowing into the North Slope that a lot of the capacity that may have existed in the Cook Inlet has now redeployed to support activity on the North Slope. So we do have to keep our eye on that because it is an ecosystem, so to speak. It isn't just solely about the companies, the operators that are the ones out producing the oil and gas. You need all of the associated service companies being well-staffed, having all the equipment that they need, and so on and so forth to enable those companies to go out and be successful. So that certainly is another element that we have to be mindful of and keep our eyes on.
Okay, Representative Sadler, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that we're here to speak on the bill. The administration has a solution to the problem. This slide does illuminate the problem, so I'm going to take advantage briefly to ask one question about how the situation. We've heard that Hilcorp has signed an extension with Homer Electric Association of their gas supply contract, and my understanding is they kind of do that by borrowing from the future. So my question is this, probably to Director Nottingham, how would this chart here how is it going to change if Hillcorp begins to produce extra gas sooner to supply HEA?
Yeah, for the record, I'm Derek Nottingham again. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, if I understand the question correctly, if Hillcorp accelerates gas production from the future currently, what I believe would happen, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I may get Johnny to kind of help me answer this question, what I believe would happen is any excess above the 70 BCF would go into storage and continue to pressure up one of those storage reservoirs. And as that excess gas were needed in the future to supply any utility, if it's home or electric, then they could call upon that gas from the storage and supply that need.
So that would actually not change the decline we see depicted in this graph. It just where it's stored, where it's short term.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, John Crowther here. I think the volumes at issue in the Homer Electric contract are quite small, very important, but quite small, and so they don't materially change this graph from a visual perspective. Were there to be an effort to pull forward large volumes of development, as Chair McKay referenced, there would be constraints on rig availability, service capacity, et cetera. So while we understand it was very natural for developers and utilities to manage these short-term kind of year-to-year supply issues in the near term, longer term, there has to be a solution like this legislation that dramatically reframes and brings new prospects online, we believe.
Thank you.
Okay, let's continue, guys. We'll take the time here. Keep going.
Derek Nottingham again. I'm getting my protocol mixed up here. But for the record, Derek Nottingham. I'll try to go through this slide very briefly. What this shows is just a snapshot of our forecast in the blue with or actually historical production in the blue and our forecast in kind of the yellow and red and our mean forecast in the kind of the dashed blue. And within that swath, you can see the actual production in the green dashes. So what this shows is that we're in terms of the last couple of years, we are tracking fairly well along with what we forecasted. So it just kind of validates, at least for the very near term, that our forecast is pretty accurate. And the assumptions going in, talking about the 15 development wells, I'll just kind of move ahead to this slide. Last year, there were 17 development wells drilled in the fields that you can see. So just for example, North Cook Inlet times three, there were three development wells drilled in the North Cook Inlet unit. So the assumption of 15 wells per year seems to be holding true, a little bit more. Some years it could be a little bit less. A lot of that just depends on where those wells are located, where what kind of problems may be encountered, and the rig is under contract for a certain amount of time, so it could be more, it could be less. But going into the future, we're still kind of seeing that roughly 15 wells per year. This slide really, we touched on the recent Cook Inlet lease sale, and so this slide really kind of describes the terms of the Cook Inlet lease sale and what that net profit share bid variable kind of means. And as the commissioner mentioned, we have the statutory ability to offer a net profit based bid variable in our lease sales with no royalty. And so we thought that this may be a way to attract any new operators, new producers, or the existing producers to go out and explore more in the Cook Inlet. That net profit share, as the commissioner mentioned, works. The producer doesn't have to pay a royalty or any net profit share payment to the state until the project achieves payout. And then once it's become cash flow positive cumulatively, then that net profit share bid variable kicks in. And you can see of the six tracks that we received bids on, the net profit share rates were 5.7% to 11%. So in essence, that's a pretty good deal for the producers who actually go out and develop those leases. I would characterize the lease sale as it was encouraging. We would definitely like to see more folks interested in the Cook Inlet, though.
So just to make sure we emphasize for the benefit of the public, these are new leases. Would you say that they're over existing structures that we believe would have gas? Mr. Nottingham, can we characterize it that way? Or how would you characterize it?
Chair McKay, I believe I would be able to say that the producers and operators that have bid on them that are willing to risk the bonus and rentals see something in those leases that's attractive to them from a development standpoint. We don't really have specific knowledge as to what they may be looking at within the division, but the fact that they would risk some amount of cash in order to acquire those leases would indicate they see something there.
And it looks like they're a blend of onshore and offshore. So, or close to shore, which means you could possibly drill them with a land rig with some version of extended reach drilling. So you might be able to drill these prospects without another jackup. Is that correct?
Chair McKay, that would be true for the onshore. The onshore prospects. I would characterize the leases that are picked up as they're near infrastructure, they're near existing units, and so that may be some of the considerations that the operators that bid on them had in mind when they bid on them, is how easy they would be to develop.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nottingham. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair McKay. This slide describes our existing oil and gas royalty statutes, and I'll just go through the slide because there's quite a lot of information on here, but it's important to have for the context of this conversation. On the left, you can see royalty statutes that apply to new leases, and then on the three columns on the right apply to existing leases. And then underneath there's statutes that apply to leases, whether they may be new leases or existing leases that have no production on them whatsoever. And so the statutes generally are in 3805-180F. And then the far left, F3, describes our commercial terms for the oil and gas leases that would be up for bid in a lease sale. Important points to note is the minimum royalty on those is typically 12.5%, but there is the option for the sliding scale royalty rates or net profit sharing. To the right of that, in 3805-180 F4 through 5, there's 5% royalty on initial production under certain circumstances, and these pertain to Cook Inlet. Specifically, 180 F4 is the Cook Inlet Discovery Royalty. That has been in place since 1996. That has only been used in one instance in the Cook Inlet. The 180 F5 was applied to new production that granted 5% royalty for 10 years to six known fields at the time of the legislation in 1998. And then four of those fields qualified, benefited from the royalty reduction, and were fairly successful developments. I would characterize this particular column as specific to the Cook Inlet, but in a lot of ways, these statutes have been very restrictive. And as you move further to right, this describes mature production. There are statutes that reduce royalty on oil production from some offshore fields under limited conditions. This has actually been a fairly effective methodology for prolonging oil production from those fields. But as I mentioned, it only applied to certain offshore fields and doesn't apply to some offshore fields now that are under production and probably could benefit from this. And then the last column here, 3805-180J, is more general. It doesn't just apply to the Cook Inlet specifically, but it's the royalty modification ability by the DNR commissioner. We can modify royalty for unproduced pools, mature pools, or shut-in pools that are uneconomic. But this is a very high bar and lengthy process. I would like, just before I conclude with this slide, just to point out that a lot of these statutes that do exist now have restrictions, and I think and can be a cumbersome process. And when a producer investor is looking at Alaska and they are considering whether a royalty modification or a lower royalty is an option, it may be a detraction to have to go through the state and go through this process and consider it. It may, you know, require heavy data requirements or a long period of analysis to get these statutes enacted.
Okay, I think I'd like to just stop briefly. Mr. Nottingham, thank you for getting us to this point. Just make a few comments to really summarize this for the public and for the benefit of our committee. You know, we're, as everybody knows, we're in a very mature basin, and we're really on an island. We're isolated. Alaska is just, we're far away from the lower 48. We're far away from other sources of gas. We really need to think of ourselves as almost like an independent country. How are we going to chart our future? It's in our hands. Nobody's going to come save us. The other thing I think we should just remind ourselves, I know everybody's pretty studied up, but there's four ways that we collect money from these fields. Royalty, which is in the Constitution, 12.5%. Then there's production tax or severance tax, corporate income tax, and property tax. So what we're talking about today is the royalty piece. And the property taxes are collected by the local governments. We're not going to mess with that. Corporate income tax is another subject. And then as far as I know, there's no production tax on a lot of these fields. Is that correct? Maybe you could just talk about that just a little bit so the committee clearly understands the difference between those four, you know, royalty, production tax. We're talking about the royalty piece, which we can affect. Can you maybe want to expand on that just a little bit, guys?
Chair McKay, John Crowther for the record, happy to speak briefly to it. I would note that, as you referenced, I don't want to speak for the Department of Revenue, but the production tax is already quite limited for production from Cook Inlet. That's driven by policy rationale, prior enactments by this body to promote development of those resources. And so that the production tax revenue associated with these fields is limited today. The property tax is an important component of state revenue, but certainly also a part of the dynamic that drives investment, that drives decisions about activity in the inlet, and has there's very active debate and dispute with different operators right now about the appropriate property tax implications and how they affect investments. The royalty, as you said, is directly within the Department of Natural Resources to manage, but is, we think, is a really key economic driver of decisions in these fields. And as Director Nottingham just went over on this slide, historically the legislature has provided significant royalty modification in different contexts for exactly this reason, to promote development, to get energy supplies on the market. And so as we look at this slide, we're looking at different historical enactments by the legislature to promote, to reduce royalty in certain circumstances to bring resources to market. And what our legislation intends to do is make those kind of royalty reductions broadly applicable and clearly applicable to new production. And so rather than having volume-driven limits or location-driven limits or a very complicated process with long timelines and uncertainty, we want it to be very clear for operators. If you're making these decisions, you'll benefit from a highly competitive royalty, and consequently, the market will see that gas.
Okay, Representative Sadler had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we're getting towards the meat of the bill and so forth, and it's good to lay out the current landscape about royalty relief and so forth. I can hear the questions being asked. We have royalty reduction relief provisions in state law. Is it fair to say they're ineffective, or were they effective for their time, and circumstances are changing and time is passing by? How would you characterize the current slate of royalty reduction provisions?
I'll take a stab at that, Representative Sadler, through the chair. Certainly, I wouldn't go so far to say that our royalty modification statutes are ineffective, but what I will say is, as Director Nottingham mentioned, that there is a very high bar there. There's a lot of analysis that has to be done by our commercial team at the Division of Oil and Gas. There's a lot of back and forth between the department and the applicant, for that royalty modification. And again, there is a high hurdle sort of set by that particular statute that governs agency action. So when it comes to certainty, or when it comes to being able to do something quickly, this is not a good tool for that. This is a better tool for more or less a one-off kind of scenario where the department has the time and the ability to delve into the economics of a particular prospect and work with an applicant on that. But I don't have the figures offhand. Maybe one of my staff members do. But I think in the history of the department, there haven't been a whole lot of instances of the department granting royalty relief. I want to say it's not many. I don't even want to throw out a number, but it's not a lot.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And this is, looking beyond you gentlemen, almost to the public, this is an example of some of the ways the state may give on the actual hard dollars in order to achieve the broader policy goals of additional production. To those who will often bewail oil tax or oil giveaways or gas giveaways, I would just make my opinion known that I think we can use, as a state, we can use our royalty and taxation provisions to encourage desirable outcomes, like providing a supply of gas that keeps us warm and dry, and that might actually be a real darn good thing. So we'll see the rest of the bill, but that's my inclination.
Well, if I might respond just briefly to Representative Sadler's comment through the chair, and actually to the chair's comments earlier, I mean, royalty, as you rightfully point out, there's four different components of where the state and or local municipalities exact some form of take. And so as we look at the economics of these projects, really some of those key drivers are which of those mechanisms have the biggest impact on economics. And so as you think about royalty and as you think about property tax, as soon as these companies put any kind of infrastructure in the ground, they start incurring due a property tax. So property taxes is a gross cost to the companies. They have to pay that regardless if they're profitable or not. They pay it regardless if more money is coming into the company or than is flowing out or vice versa. So that's one of the key drivers as well to economics, is just how much of these types of costs the company is having to bear, particularly in those early years when there is no money, there is no revenue coming in through the door. And royalty, again, is one that hits companies early on, because they, in the first few years of production, obviously they're trying to recoup all of the costs of that particular development project, all of the money that they've sunk into acquiring the leases and doing exploration work and drilling wells and bringing bits of kit and equipment to bear to actually produce the oil, pipeline construction, you know, you name it. They have to recover those costs. But in the process of recovering those costs, as they start to produce, they then incur a royalty obligation from the state, which, again, has a big impact on the overall economics of the project, because it stretches out then the amount of time it takes for them to actually start earning enough money from their operations to not only repay all the money that they have spent to get to that point, but then to start earning enough of return to repay their lenders and shareholders and so forth and so on. So I think the committee rightfully should look at all of those different elements, understanding where in the cycle they have an impact on project economics, and also understanding that in order to really get new projects or projects that have not yet been sanctioned over the edge, really focusing on those elements that will provide benefit to the company, particularly in those early years, will have more of a meaningful impact into helping make those go, no-go decisions, maybe versus policies more oriented towards fields that are already in production or more mature down the road.
Okay, now probably need to keep moving. Representative Mears had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'd like to drill down a little bit into Representative Sadler's first part of that question. In the second column here, it looks very similar to what we're doing here on this very brief summary, that we've got existing leases, no production, and a reduction in royalty rate from 12.5% to 5%. It doesn't look like it was heavily utilized. What's the difference between that and what we're looking at today?
Representative Mears, through the chair, John Crowther here. I think in that second column, AS 3805-180F4 and 5, we're talking about two particular provisions under that are in current law. F4, for discovery royalty, that's where a new field is discovered. There has to be certifications of that well and of the production and the status of the reservoir pre-well, and only the royalty is reduced for that one lease that the well is located on. As Director Nottingham mentioned, that authority has been applied for and utilized one time. So, and we think that's in part due to how narrow and focused it is. A given unit may involve 5, 10, even more than that leases, and so that royalty reduction on the production from the only the discovery lease is a limitation there. On the F5, you know, that was some time ago, but I think it's fair to characterize that provision as being successful. It targeted reduced royalty for 6 different fields to get them online. So it was successful at the time in that 4 of those 6 fields did go into production, provided oil and gas that the states benefited from. And so our legislation essentially would be expanding that F5 provision for all pools that are not currently in commercial production. So new resources getting onto the market would have that highly competitive 5% rate. We'd hope we'd see the same success that those prior fields did by coming online in the 90s and early 2000s.
Okay, thanks for those questions. Let's move on to the next slide, please, for the sake of time.
Derek Nottingham, for the record. Why this legislation is necessary, I think we've covered a lot of that. Just to reemphasize, nearly 70% of Alaskans use the Cook Inlet natural gas for heating, energy, and electricity. Cook Inlet supplies, as we've talked about, are forecasted to drop below demand, and there are several significant known gas fields that we've mentioned, Cosmopolitan, Kitchen Lights, that need to be developed, and we think that this legislation will encourage that. And then and obviously policies and actions to support future developments need to be taken today, because time, as you mentioned, Chair McKay, is of the essence. More competitive development terms actually increase the total recovery and utilization of our resources, and will generate, we think, more revenue, because as the commissioner mentioned, 5% of something is definitely better than 12.5% of nothing. And so that's really why the bill, we think, is necessary. And it we just feel like that it provides these makes these resources available as we kind of move forward into the future and work on longer term energy solutions for the rail belt. It's not we're not advertising this as the solution to end all solutions, but it is a sort of a bridge to longer term solutions.
Okay, Representative McCabe has a question.
Thanks. So I'm curious, the leases for Kitchen Lights and Cosmopolitan, they have performance clauses in them. How far along are we in that sort of parameters?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative McCabe. Yes, both the Kitchen Lights unit and the Cosmopolitan unit have a plan of development which requires the operator to state what its plans are for the current year and any future plans. We work with those operators in a lot of cases to understand their plans and put and help them identify what we think they should be doing in the next year and the following years. And in both of those cases, we've indicated very strongly recently that we expect to see those units develop, I would say, expediently.
So follow up?
A follow-up, Representative McCabe.
Sure, but in the lease, in the initial lease, it's for a time period, right? Yeah. 10 years, 5-10 years, I think you said, somewhere earlier in there. So how far along are we in those leases coming up to the end of the lease where they have to perform, or we send it to somebody else that can perform?
Representative McCabe through the chair, John Crowther here. Both those units are currently in production, and so that production holds the unit. Now, there are authorities for the department to review both the status and level of development activities for the unit itself and the scope and size of that unit. We have not utilized the authorities to pare back or modify those units. There would still be some period of time before those authorities would be ripe, so to speak. But that's a complicated and separate discussion perhaps about the status there. I would say that that plan of development occurs annually, and so we expect to see performance under these recently approved plans of development that have significant development obligations for both those operators. And certainly if this legislation were to be enacted or something like it, we would be able to very specifically say to those operators, it is a highly competitive environment. You have to take development activities in the near term, or the state will move forward with potential actions under the unit.
Just one
follow up, Representative McCabe.
Sure, McCabe. So maybe we can define in production. Because to me, in production means gas is flowing. I don't think that's what you mean.
Yeah, Representative McCabe through the chair. The Kitchen Lights unit last year, I believe, produced near 4 BCF of gas, so did contribute to the total demand. We believe that additional wells and development could push that number up and should push that number up to see the full development of that resource. That obligation is there under the unit agreement. And similarly, the Bluecrest Cosmopolitan unit is producing oil today and a small amount of gas that's being used in the market as well. But we similarly feel that the full development of that resource with additional wells needs to be done to meet those obligations.
Thanks. It's helpful.
Okay, let's try to finish up. Go ahead with the next slide, please, Mr. Nottingham.
For the record, Derek Nottingham, what this bill does is it grants reduced royalty of 5% for the first 10 years of production from pools in the Cook Inlet that have not previously been produced for commercial sale. It includes known resources that are not yet in production and resources that could be discovered through further exploration. It applies to any state land in the Cook Inlet, whether or not it's in an existing field unit or lease. What it doesn't do is does not reduce royalties for pools presently in commercial production. And I believe this is the last slide. Actually the second to last slide. I apologize. So what the bill does is it amends 3805-180F5, one of the ones that we were talking about previously, to read, instead of granting royalty of 5% to six potential fields, it basically grants royalty to any new production in the Cook Inlet, any new pools. So the lessee of all or part of an oil or gas pool in the Cook Inlet sedimentary basin that, subject to the determination of the commissioner, has not previously produced for commercial sale oil or gas shall pay a royalty of 5% on oil and gas or oil or gas produced for sale from that pool for 10 years following the date on which the production of commercial sale commences. So a couple of things to point out in there. What has not has not previously produced for commercial sale or oil or gas mean? What we mean by that is production from wells or sidetracked that are drilled after the effective date of the legislation that would have not otherwise would have not been produced from other or existing wells. So it applies to wells that would be drilled that find new reserves. Subject to the determination of the commissioner means that DNR considers a variety of factors when it makes this determination, including the source of oil or gas and whether that's produced in the past, the proximity in a drainage area of existing wells, and even the time frame for recovery of those existing wells. Examples of qualifying production, we're thinking a newly drilled well or sidetrack from the edge of an existing or previously produced development could qualify. A new well or sidetrack from an unproduced accumulation of oil and gas, such as, for instance, the Cosmopolitan gas accumulation would apply. The lessee or lessees shall jointly or separately apply for royalty reduction in royalty for one or more wells with each application. That is, simply put, that means that they can apply for more than one well at a time. And obviously the data and interpretations would be supplied to DNR, and we may, you know, require further data as we see it necessary. And a well or accumulation may be determined to receive reduced royalties before a well is drilled when supported by data and interpretations. I believe the next slide gets into the language of the bill. So section one is the language change to 3805F5. As I mentioned, the original statute granted 5% royalty to six specific fields. This broadens that to include, as we mentioned, new production in the Cook Inlet regardless of discovery date, and removes limits on eligible volumes of oil and gas during the 10-year period. Eligibility, as we mentioned, is subject to the determination of the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner rather than being automatic. And it repeals these following statutes, 310503I, which that statute relates to the duties of the AOGCC, and a particular paragraph that outlines the procedure for approving PODs or plans of development. That statute is no longer necessary because DNR, not the AOGCC, is the agency that approves plans of development now. And then the other statute that we request be repealed is 3805-180DD. This relates to the date of establishing production from those six fields that were originally specified in 3805-180F5. And section three is that the legislation takes effect immediately under AS01-10070C. I believe that's all of them.
Okay, I'm glad we got through the last couple of slides. It's getting pretty heavy. I have a couple questions, but I think I'll save them for individual discussion. Does the committee have any immediate questions at this point? Okay, I was handed one question. Let me try to get it off. Slide 10 talks about gas storage. Kenai Gas Pool 6 field. The note says could have 500 BCF or more of gas storage capability. Can you verify that? Can we verify that?
Representative McKay, or Chair McKay, for the record, John Crowther, I don't think on the record right now we can get back to the committee with some specifics. I'd say there's two things that drives the size of a storage asset: the raw geologic capacity, obviously the prior volume produced from a field is a guide there, and then also the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission sets a pressure limit based on the reservoir and regulations. So there's some limits to what size of storage asset can be utilized, but we can get back to the committee with our understanding of the general size of that, that asset.
Okay, Representative Sadler, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Boyle, Crowther, leases are for 5 years, extended five more years. Given the long lead times we heard about for Cosmopolitan Kitchen Lights, is there a reason why this legislation limits the royalty relief to 10 years? Could it exist beyond? Could we, even if a lease or a unit is, has a smaller timeline, could we offer that incentive for a longer period of time and be more effective?
Go ahead.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think we set that 10-year period in the proposed legislation based on the, you know, the history. Historically, these provisions have had a 10-year time period, time for the legislature and the public to assess the effectiveness of the program, et cetera. I think it would be a strong signal to have a different, longer period, but that's a consideration we'd be happy to talk with the committee about.
And would that tend to cause confusion or dissimilarity that might cause confusion in the industry?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think that the clear statutory language, whatever that period set, that can be assessed by accountants and professionals, and
thank you.
It won't create confusion there.
Okay, Representative Baker, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'm not sure who to address this question to, but regarding the fiscal note on this being zeroed out, I understand it's hard to put a price tag on potential, but are there any numbers of what it would look like if there were five producers taking advantage of this, or anything that would kind of show how this would benefit revenue-wise moving forward?
Representative Baker, through the chair, the department has internally and can present to the committee different kind of hypothetical models about development scenarios, what we think might accrue both in terms of production volumes and royalty to the state. I would note that while it's dependent on a lot of assumptions and variables, it's very possible that this net revenue impact of this legislation is positive and potentially significantly positive, because under the status quo, these resources are not being developed. While we have a 12.5% royalty, we're not receiving any. We're getting 12.5% of nothing, as the commissioner noted. And so receiving 5% of new production that otherwise wouldn't be in the market could be a significant revenue benefit.
Okay, Representative Mears, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I appreciate that I've got clarification that we're looking at a modification of something that's been existing. Let's click in there. The statute that's being modified just applied to a couple of different fields. Now we call pools, apparently. But this is for the entire Cook Inlet Basin. It also appears to be in perpetuity. Is this forever and ever, or is there a limit of the time for when this can initiate as well?
Yeah, Representative Mears, through the chair, John Boyle, commissioner, for the record. I think right now the intent is for it to go on indefinitely, because as long as we continue to have a reliance on Cook Inlet energy to heat our homes and enable us to flip the light switch on, I think we want to continue to provide those incentives to companies to go out and develop more resource in the Cook Inlet. Because I see, again, the state's interest in seeing oil and gas development take place is that enables us to monetize our resources, which in turn enables us to grow our permanent fund and provide revenues for all the state services that we've come to know and love. And we want to keep that train on the track, so to speak.
Well, and I might add that, you know, what we haven't mentioned is more activity in Cook Inlet creates local jobs, local revenue, and our constituents really like that. So so I appreciate our attention to this very important matter. I think it's one of the most important subjects that we could deal with this session. So I want to thank the committee for your patience today and hanging in there on this important topic. So we need to go to the next bill, unless there's any further questions. I want to thank Commissioner Boyle, Deputy Commissioner Crowther, and Director Nottingham for running us through this presentation. Gentlemen, thank you very much. And I will take just a brief at ease to reset the table. Okay, I'd like to call the meeting of House Resources back to order. And what I needed to announce is I will set aside House Bill 276 in committee for further work. And I want to thank everyone that participated in preparing HB 276 for our review. So now we move to House Bill 223. I will now bring House Bill 223, also related to Cook Inlet Gas, before the committee. Fortunately, we have Representative Rauscher here today. Would you like to offer a sponsor statement and introduce your bill, Representative Rauscher?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman McKay, I appreciate you hearing this bill. I also want to thank the committee for hearing this bill also. My name is Representative George Rauscher, District 29. And I would also like to just start off by thanking the DNR for the presentation that you saw before you, before here. These bills are similar. The background that they provided was excellent. The background that we all listened to, that we all talked about, I believe serves both of these bills pretty much some changes, some differences. But an act of House Bill 223, an act relating to the production tax royalty rates on certain gas and providing for an effective date. House Bill number 223 represents a crucial step in revitalizing Alaska's natural gas industry, particularly focusing on the Cook Inlet region. This bill addressed longstanding barrier to investment in this sector, the current production tax or royalty rates. By proposing strategic modifications to these rates, HB 223 aims to elevate Alaska's competitiveness and attractiveness for natural gas investments. The legislation is crafted to stimulate economic growth and ensure a stable natural gas supply for our state. It introduces vital changes, such as allowing more flexible royalty and leasing options, reducing royalty rates for specific leases in Cook Inlet and its sedimentary basin, and implementing a tax cap for gas production in the region. Additionally, it establishes a zero tax rate for new gas exploration efforts, which will actually be sold to utility companies with a focus on in-state utility prioritization. The impact of HB 223 extends beyond more economic matrix. It's about securing a prosperous future for Alaska through a more robust and dynamic natural gas industry. This is bill is specifically targets the revision of tax and royalty rates for the natural gas in the Cook Inlet Basin. It leverages gas that may never be produced. We're not giving away our resources on this. I want you to know that there's been talk of that, where we're giving away our resources. These resources will be spent in state where they're needed in state. And that's the purpose behind this bill. And I believe the one before that. It's very important that we understand that this is not just giving them away to other countries. And, I like the previous statement, 5% of something is better than 100% of nothing. So that's what these bills are about, getting something out of it. Right now we are faced with a high price of gas, and it's not due to the amount of gas available in the inlet. It's due to the availability of gas in the inlet. The producers, when we talk to them, you know, there's an awful lot of talk about renewable resources. There's money that comes in for these projects. It may not be gigantic money at this point, but there is money coming in for those. And that kind of says to them, I don't know, are we getting pushed out of the picture? Does that make them really want to jump in and start investing in oil and gas? Okay, so that's some of the things we're up against. Some of the history on the investment the part of it is just not as robust as it used to be because of how we look at hydrocarbons. So I think what they need to do is be enticed to actually help us out here. We need to find more gas. We need to keep it at a special rate for the utility companies that will utilize it. That's what this bill intends to do. I'm going to turn this over to my chief of staff, my staff, to Craig Valdez, and he'll go over the sectional for you.
Okay, please proceed with the sectional, Mr. Valdez. It's not very long, and we can check that box, and then we can go to questions.
Of course.
Thank you.
For the record, Craig Valdez for staff representative George Rauscher. Starting with the sectional here, section one modifies AS380518F. Page one, lines 5 through 6. This section is amended to include subsection MM as an exception to when the commissioner may issue oil and gas leases or leases for gas only on state land. Page two, line 14, the word no is replaced with not. Section 2 modifies AS380518F. On page 8, lines 17 through 24, a new subsection MM is added to discuss contracts and royalty shares. Section 3, AS43.55.011I, on page 8, lines 26, this section is amended to include subsection Q as an exemption to the tax levied by subsection E of that particular section. Section 4, AS43.55.011P, on page 9, lines 15, this section is amended to include Q as an exemption for the allotted time following the commencement of the commercial production of oil and gas production produced from leases or properties in the state that are outside the Cook Inlet Sedimentary Basin. Section 5, AS43.55.011, page 9, lines 23-27, a new subsection Q is added that explains how the levy of tax under subsection E of this section may not exceed zero for new gas that was explored only on or after the 5th of June 2023 and offered for sale to an in-state electric or heating utility company before being offered for sale to another person or entity. Section 6, AS43.55.020A. Page 17, lines 13-14, a new subsection H was added to further discuss installment payments of the estimated tax levied and includes subsection Q. Section 7 is effective date. Sections 1 and 2 effective dates, and Section 8 is effective date clause.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Valdez. So my first question, Representative Rauscher, that's obvious. The previous bill addressed royalties only. It looks like your bill addresses production taxes and royalties. Is that correct? Is that what it looks like to me?
Through the chair, Craig Valdez, staff representative Rauscher, that is correct, yes.
Okay. Would you like to tell us how you impact those two more specifically, or should we look at a particular page in the bill? Or
yeah.
I'm trying to stay one step ahead of Representative Sadler.
You're doing good.
Mercifully. Representative Sadler and I have a special relationship. I'm able to pick on him at will, and he understands that it's absolutely fine.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, sir.
No.
So, through the chair, Craig Valdez, software.
Okay.
It affects the clause that talks about them, but it doesn't change production tax in this bill.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. Just seeking to understand what you want to do, Representative Rauscher. Friendly questions.
I understand. So just a little background here. I sit on resources. My name is Representative Rauscher, District 29, for the record. I sit on resources. Last year, we had many of the gas producers come in here and talk to us. And we were handed a chart. And it said, look, here's five bullets. And what are the most important things that you could think of that might be able to change the situation in the future? And this was actually the first line on that chart. this bill, that we could actually work in that direction. So I began in June to write this bill following when we got out of committee, when we got out of session, and it was actually written, and as you saw, it was pre-filed. So I just want you to know that there probably is some redundancy because I'm not sure that the administration saw mine coming, and mine has been already pre-filed. I think there's some overlap, and I think there's something we could probably do to make that less of chasing two bills and maybe chase one.
Okay.
So anyway, just letting you know where we're at there.
Sure. Okay. Questions for members? Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rauscher, if you point out, there's a lot of similarities here, but I don't have notes on this, so I'm going to try and pull out some things that I see are the same and different. So it appears like the governor's bill that there is no, this is in perpetuity. So as for all future cooking like us discovery, what's different is that the governor's bill has got a 10-year timeline on the field production. So I think that's a difference. We've also got a zero royalty if the gas is offered for an in-state utility, but reduced by 50%, which I think would be 6.25%. So it's similar, but not quite there. So those are some of the things that I'm picking out. Am I getting that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ruff, through the chair, to Representative Mears, correct?
Did I miss anything?
There's a few things there, but
okay.
those were probably the majority, the more important. Yeah.
Quickly becoming an oil tax expert, Representative Mears.
Sure.
Okay. Chair, Representative Rauscher, ours does encompass a bigger area than just Cook Inlet, because there are fines all around that might come into play that the utilities could probably use. So we came up with a bigger area than just the Cook Inlet. So I think that might be one of the differences you might have missed.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Mears?
Thank you. That was one thing I had known to my staff to follow up on. What is that area? Is it in the entire state or South Central, or what's the geographic limit?
Representative Mears, through the chair, Craig Waldez. It would be south of the North Slope, so Middle Earth in Cook Inlet as well.
Middle Earth is usually somewhere around Fairbanks, I believe. Nothing against Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. Representative Armstrong?
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Rauscher, I'm curious if you had explored other incentives that you thought could be helpful in incentivizing more production, and maybe I meant to ask this to the commissioner, so now you're getting the question. maybe if you can talk a little bit about why you chose this, if in your discovery process you found that this would be the most incentivizing to the producers and operators we have.
Well, I appreciate the question. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, Representative Armstrong, you know, when you see, as a representative of part of the valley, understanding part of the matrix that's involved with getting fuel to supply electricity and power throughout the rail belt, you have to do something, in my opinion, that will not just provide help for one entity only. You have to provide something for both the parties or more than one. And so now when you're actually selling, if you can sell this gas and you can sell it to the utility companies, I want to reward that action because the utility companies need it. And I also want to make it to where they want to go out and search out. And so killing two birds with one stone, I figured up all of the things out there. This was something that could kill two birds with one stone and help out everybody, because I believe if we could work with the problem on the rail belt, it's going to help out PCE. It's going to help out all the way around the state. And so we have to start working and spreading this whole thing, because sooner or later, we've got to worry about the rest of the state too, right? And that's what this is all about, sitting on energy as the chair. And I believe that's just as important as the rail belt. We have to start somewhere, and we have to start working toward covering the whole gamut of the state. So this is where I figured we had a majority of the people in the state conglomerated at one place, and they could best benefit. The ratepayers are benefiting. The utility companies are benefiting. We're not buying gas overseas. The producers out in the inlet producing gas are benefiting. And I thought, this is a great idea. I hope that answered your question.
Okay. Representative Armstrong, follow up.
Thank you, through the chair. And perhaps to you, Chair, and Rep. Rauscher, I think something that would be interesting, I appreciate the 0% to kind of incentivize the payment to utilities, but I also thought it was a really compelling case of how this can help industry and other things come online, capturing more of the mining value chain. And so I could see it being interesting to do a hybrid of the two bills. And yours is, you just reduce it to 6.25%. Is that the reduced royalty rate if it doesn't get offered to a utility first? Is that right? Okay.
To the chair, yes, correct.
Thanks. Okay, cool. That's all.
In my office, we were preparing a table comparing the two bills and some other ideas as well. So maybe at some point that will be available to the committee, you know, to help organize this this analysis. So any other questions from the committee today on the HB 223? All right. Seeing none, I will set aside House Bill 223 in committee for further work. Thank you very much, Representative Rauscher and Mr. Valdez, for presenting the bill to us today on this such important topic. We don't have any other business that I'm aware of today. So our next meeting is Friday, February 2nd at 1 p.m. And I will call us adjourned at 2:45 p.m. Thank you.